It looks like it's working. So here we are on the, I can't see that dial.
The 12th?
Yes.
Is today the 12th? Okay. We're on the 12th of January. We're in the study of the post-exilic history of Israel. There are six books that we have to look at to get all of that history that we have in the scriptures. There's three historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And Esther's where we'll be here this morning. And there's three prophetic books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last three Old Testament minor prophets. And the story begins in the book of Ezra in about the year 536 B.C. What's happened historically is that the 70-year Babylonian captivity has ran its course. The new sheriff in town is a Persian king named Cyrus. He took over and they threw out the Babylonians, and that brought that 70-year exile to an end. And this guy was very kindly disposed toward the Jews, this Cyrus, King Cyrus. See him down there at the bottom? These are the Persian kings down here at the bottom on this chart. He told the people, he told the Jews, he said, hey, if you guys want to go home, you can. If you want to leave the Persian Empire, you can go back to Judah, and we will help you to do that. We'll fund your trip back. He appointed a guy named Zerubbabel to be the governor of Judah when they went back. And he and his bud, the high priest of the day, one Joshua of sorts, led a caravan of Jews back from Babylon, which was now a Persian empire, not a Babylonian empire, back to Judah in about that time frame, about 536 B.C. And about 50,000 of them got together and went back. Who knows what percentage of all of them that were down there? I don't know. But we had a head count shown to us there. And so about 50,000 Jews came back under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua, and they started to rebuild the temple. And this guy actually not only helped him financially to get back, he raised a bunch of money for them to rebuild the temple. We're thinking somewhere in the $90 to $100 million range based upon the coinage and so on that we have there in Scripture. And they got to work and went pretty good for 2 years, from about 536 for a couple of years, and then they got intimidated into inaction by their enemies, and they did nothing. They sat down for the next 15 years. So the temple went nowhere for about 15 more years after that two-year pretty good start. So God said, well, I'm going to send some guys down there to jumpstart these people. They ain't doing nothing. And he did. He sent two of his minor prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, and they went down there at about, oh, let's say around 520, 521, along in through there, about 15 years later, and they both ministered to the exiles who were doing nothing with a message of rebukes and encouragement. Zechariah's was more encouragement than rebukes. Haggai, maybe a little bit the opposite. But in whatever the case, their messages were effective and they got back to work. They did good. And they finally got the thing completed then in 516. So about 20 years later, they got the temple built out of that 20 years, maybe 5 years worth of work and 15 years worth of laying around doing nothing. But they finally got that sucker built. And Ezra, we got up to Ezra chapter 6, describing all of that. And then we said, okay, let's time out. Let's go over and see what was happening in the book of Esther, because it occurred between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. So we left off our study in Ezra with the first wave of Jews back there, jump-started by Haggai and Zechariah, and completing the temple in around 516. So that's where we left off the Ezra narrative and went over and started looking at the Esther narrative, because that takes place during the time frame that we're studying here, and that's what we're studying now. Now, in this storyline, God's name is not mentioned in this book. It's ironic that of all the 66 books that we have, this is the one and only one that doesn't even mention his name. But his hand can be seen at work in the lives of the exiles that have come back, or in the lives of the exiles that are still down there that haven't come back yet. His hand can nevertheless be seen in a variety of ways, a large variety of ways. I'll review all of those ways for you when we're done with this book, and we'll talk about those a little bit. But in this story of Esther, we have a Jewish, Jewish orphaned young lady, sort of adopted by her cousin named Mordecai, who is apparently in sort of a father-daughter relationship, age bracket type thing between the two of them. So we have about five major characters in this storyline. We have the king of Persia. His name was Ahasuerus. We have his initial wife named Vashti, V-A-S-H-T-I, I guess that's how you pronounce it. We have Esther and Mordecai, the two Jewish prominent Jewish players in this storyline. And then we have this real stink pot that we're going to meet today. His name was Haman, H-A-M-A-N. Those are the five main characters in this story. And in this story, we're going to see the divine providence of God at work over and over and over and over again, taking care of his people, even though his people aren't paying any attention to him. You don't have to earn divine providence. God just takes care of it as he wants to. We're seeing all of that. So our story began with a banquet pitched by the Persian king Ahasuerus. And at that banquet, he had all of his high muckety-mucks throughout his 127 precinct kingdom from Ethiopia to India. He had this big banquet and everything there, and he wanted to get his trophy wife to come out and show herself off to all of his drunken sot buds that he had there at the banquet. And the queen said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I ain't coming in there with all of these guys around." And we talked a little bit about how the judgment on her part there is so extraordinary to really understand, because there's no doubt she understood her role as trophy wife of the king. She knew what she was supposed to do. But in these circumstances, she chose not to do anything except to tell him to shove it. She ain't coming in there. Well, my goodness, why not just go in there and slap him around a little bit? He'd accomplish about the same thing. Major world-class embarrassment for this guy. So he has to consult his advisors as to, what does he do about this? How do we handle the situation of the queen stiff-arming me when I ask her to come in here? And you got to wonder where her head was. I mean, she might have been a little nippy herself, because she's got to know how to handle this situation. She's got to know that her life is on the line here. When she's been summoned by the king, she can't tell him to get lost. She's got to do something. And even if it means enduring a little bit of ogling from these guys or whatever the case may be, do it. You're still breathing the next morning. But she said, not going to do it. And so he's just totally flabbergasted, and he calls in his advisor and said, what am I going to do about this woman that ain't going to do what I tell her to? And they said, you got to just get rid of her. There needs to be a job opening at the queen slot in the kingdom here. Get her out of here. And so he does. So our story has a job opening in it at the very beginning of the queen of the Persian Empire. Largest empire on the planet has no queen there. Well, we got a candidate, though, don't we? Candidate's name is Esther. She's an orphan. Her parents are dead. But she's got a cousin named Mordecai who's kind of watching over her like a father, taking care of her. And the counselors to the Persian king suggest to him that the way he solves this problem and the way he fills that job opening is he calls old Jack and has him put together a beauty pageant for him. And so that's what they do. The way to fill the job opening of Queen of the Persian Empire now becomes a beauty pageant. And our candidate here, Miss Esther, that's right up her alley. That's her shtick. She's a beautiful young lady. She has a chance in a beauty pageant of being selected to be replaced. Even though they scarf up all these beautiful young virgins in the Persian Empire, and the king goes through a audition sequence with all of them, our girl Esther wins. How does she beat all these other beautiful young ladies? Well, we keep suggesting that divine providence is alive and well, and that's the explanation for her beating out all these others. So she becomes the queen of the Persian Empire. This Jewish young lady, and by the way, they don't know she's Jewish yet. She kept that to herself. And her cousin Mordecai, same way. So that hasn't been made known just yet. And our story then progresses to the point where we now have a young Jewish lady queen over the Persian Empire. Jewish. Now, adding to the extraordinary results we've seen so far is the fact that her cousin Mordecai, he's hanging around the gate to the palace and so on there. I don't know what kind of job he's got that he can do that, but he does. And he catches wind somehow or another of a plot to kill the king, Mordecai, Esther's cousin, catches wind of this plot by two eunuchs that are working for the king. And she reports the plot to the king in Mordecai's name, has him associated with the information, and they research it and find out, yeah, these guys were plotting to kill him. So they axe those two villains, and Mordecai now becomes the king's new best friend. Esther's cousin, the queen's cousin, is now well-received and well-liked in the kingdom. So, wow, things are sure coming together nicely here, aren't they? Mordecai is doing well. Esther's doing better than well. She's on the top of the heap. So that all looks and sounds good. And then we got this new player comes on the scene in chapter 3, Esther chapter 3. His name is Haman. Let's pick our trail up there. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of that guy, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Now here comes another star player. He happens to be, however, a descendant of Esau. He is an Agagite. He is an enemy of the Jews. Now, he doesn't know Esther is a Jew, and he doesn't know Mordecai yet is a Jew. But this guy is, he's riding the crest. He's getting promoted over his peers. He is kind of like head of the cabinet in Persia, you know, that kind of thing. And he's doing well. So he's making his move in the business world and in the political world and doing extremely well. And all of the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to this guy, Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now, this guy, Haman, has been promoted so highly in the Persian Empire that I guess he requested it, but whether he did or not, the king told everybody, hey, look, when this guy says jump, all you say is how high. You bow down and pay homage to this guy, Haman. Everybody. Well, old Mordecai, he's got a problem. He apparently is Daniel-like enough that he ain't about to bow down and pay homage to somebody other than the Jewish God. Now, we saw Daniel was very fervent in that, in his adherence to worshiping God, praying to God every day, and all kinds of stuff like that. Mordecai doesn't seem to be quite the same spiritual piece of cloth that Daniel is, but he's at least not going to bow down to this guy, Haman. The heck with that stuff. So he doesn't. And when the king's servants who were at the king's gate, verse 3, said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Why are you trying to act like Daniel and his friends here under these circumstances? So they knew he wasn't bowing down, like Daniel's enemies knew he wasn't either. Now, it was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. So, after a little bit of trying to persuade him, I guess, to bow down before Haman like everybody else, Mordecai tells these guys, no, I'm a Jew, and I have a God, the God of my people. I will bow down to him, but not Haman. So, they then make it known to this guy Haman that there's a Jew in the community that is not obeying the king's law and is not bowing down to him. Got the situation in mind there? See how everything's going so far? And when Haman, verse 5, saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. Now, what in life does this guy want? He's being promoted extensively from a political, economic viewpoint. There's no doubt he's making more money than he knows how to spend. He's been raised to, like, third in the kingdom by the king in terms of esteem and admiration and so on and so forth. And all he can do when he learns that there's this one guy that ain't doing anything is that he's filled with rage. It drives him nuts that somebody, a Jew in particular, someone that he doesn't like to begin with, his ancestry and the Jews' ancestry goes back to Jacob and Esau, and they are in conflict. He doesn't like this guy, Mordecai. So, And verse 6, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now, if you were Haman, and you were progressing socially and economically and politically like he was, I mean, you no doubt had a golden bird nest on the ground. You think maybe you could somehow or another have handled or adjusted to the fact that you got this one guy who happens to think you're a dirtbag, but that's his viewpoint. You don't have to care all about that. And just kind of let it go? Could you maybe let it slide and just continue to enjoy your wonderful life that you have acquired for yourself otherwise? He can't do that. He's so filled with hatred that it overrides any other logical decision-making that he might do. And he wants this guy, Mordecai, dead. And furthermore, he wants Mordecai's whole tribal affiliation, or in this case, national affiliation, the Jews, he wants them dead too. Hatred is just kind of an all-consuming emotion, isn't it? All of the good stuff that this guy could list that is falling into his lap, and he can't get past it. He hates the Jews so badly that he wants to destroy every one of them, regardless of what position he might be in the kingdom. We see people like that from time to time, don't we? They're so hate-filled that they basically will pass on other positive benefits and blessings that they have received to try to fulfill that hatred in whatever the case may be. And he's that way in the extreme. So in the first month, in verse 7, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now what Haman is doing here is that he's got a set of dice. It's called the Pur, P-U-R. If you put an I-M on the backside of that word, it makes it double or more than one. Purim means there's more than one dice. A pur is one dice. So you got a couple of dice. And he's trying to decide how he goes about and when he does something to try to nail Mordecai and his people. So he's casting lots every month as the year goes by. They're called Purim, the dice. He's casting those to decide when to do this. And he goes throughout the whole year, first month into the 12th month. And so it finally strikes him, and he does this. Verse 8, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "Hey, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain." So Haman now takes on the role of trying to think for the king and telling the king what he should think. And he says, "Hey, we got these Jews all over the place. They're all scattered throughout your kingdom. And they don't pay attention to your laws." Now, the only one we know anything about is this bowing down. This is like Daniel 3. You know, like he built that obelisk to honor Nebuchadnezzar did to honor himself, and when the music cranked up, you had to hit the dirt. And Daniel and his friends wouldn't do that. This is a very similar situation here. But that's all we know that Mordecai has done. He hasn't violated other laws or rules that we know anything about. This one conflicted with God's laws, and so it was a problem. But he says, he concludes to the king that, "Hey, you need to get rid of these people. They're an enemy to you. So if it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed." Hey, if that's pleasing to you, let's just destroy all of these people in your kingdom that are of a certain ethnic orientation here. The Jews, let's get rid of them, and I will pay you 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasury. This is about $360 million, by the way. So Haman's suggestion to the king is that you kill off all these Jews in your kingdom, and I'll give you $360 mil to go into the national treasury, and you can do with it as you wish. Where's he going to get that money? Well, he thinks he's going to get it from the Jews he's going to kill. He's going to take their stuff. So he's calculated, I suppose, the number of Jews and average net worth and so on, and he's come up with, well, he can afford to give away to the king $360 million that he steals from these Jews that he kills. So then the king took his signet ring from his hand and he gave it to Haman. Now this is in essence giving Haman a blank check. But what does he not do? He doesn't inquire, what the heck is going on here, Haman? Who are these people? Why are you so intent on killing them? He doesn't do a good job of kingliness, does he? He just says to the guy, here's my ring. Go write whatever you want and stamp it with my ring. That makes it law. And you can do whatever you want to. Very, very poor leadership on the part of the Persian king to just simply acquiesce to Haman without understanding more of what's going on here. Why doesn't he do a better job than that? Why didn't Vashti do a better job than she did? It's called divine providence. So he gives a ring to Haman, and he's the son of this guy, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. So giving, in essence, a blank check to a Jew-hating character and not even inquiring about it or what's going on is sort of like handwriting on the wall what's going to take place, isn't it? The Jews are in trouble. And the king said to Haman, the silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please. So kill them all off if you want to. Take whatever you can get from them. And I don't know if he took any of the money at all for the national treasury. So this guy Haman, this hate-filled lunatic, has gotten permission from the king to kill off all of the Jews in the Persian Empire. Esther's a Jew. Is he going to kill her? Mordecai's a Jew, the guy who's saved the king's bacon with the plot information. He's a Jew. He's going to kill him? This looks like the divine providence has lost its grip. Something's happened. Things are turning bad here now. God's people are all going to be killed off. Or one might think. So the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of the king Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. So all of these decrees are written up in the language of each province, so everybody in the Persian Empire, all 127 of them, are getting the message correctly. It's going to be, let's have a kill all the Jews day. That sounds like fun. And we'll just take all their stuff. And the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy and kill and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, to seize their possessions as plunder. So we strike up this Let's Kill the Jews Day. It's the 13th of the last month of the year. And that's when we'll just go in and take all of their stuff and kill all of them out of here. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? Can you imagine the hatred in this guy's heart toward mankind, that's a plot he would come up with and seals it with the king's notary stamp. Now, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the peoples so that they should be ready for this day. Get your sword sharpened. Get all your killing machines ready to go. We're going to kill all the Jews on the 13th of Adar when that rolls around. So the couriers went out impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital. And while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. So a great uproar occurs right there locally where they all are, but it really concerned the king so much that he and Haman sat down and had a cold beer. That's all that mattered to him, nothing. Everybody else is just going nuts. You can imagine the Jews were going crazy. And so the date is set. 13th of Adar. Or the 12th month, I may not have that month right, but the date has been set to National Kill All the Jews Day, put in place by this miserable excuse for a human being named Haman. So, the storyline has sure taken a turn for the worse for the Jews here, didn't it? It looked pretty good there for a while. You had Esther the queen, she's a Jew. You had Mordecai the informant, he's a Jew. These guys are sitting in good shape. But now here comes this Jew-hating scumbag named Haman, and he has put together a plot with the king's agreement to kill them all. Now there's this one major little problem that we haven't seen how it's worked out yet, but we probably ought to remind ourselves of, and it comes from Genesis chapter 12, 13, and 15, and that is, I will bless them that bless you, and I will curse them that curse you. How's that going to play out here, I'm wondering? Because there's a plot in play here to kill all of them. But God said, people who curse you, I'm going to curse them. We just don't know how yet, do we? We got to read on a little bit to get that answer. So let's do that. Let's read on. Verse 1 of chapter 4. So when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. This is a symbol of mourning. And he went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. So Mordecai is displaying great mourning through the dress that he's wearing, and you spread these ashes on yourself, and it's just a symbol of that, of mourning. And he went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. So he could get up to the gate, but he can't get past it because he has on all these symbols of mourning, and you can't do that in the king's presence. So in each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. So the Jews are displaying their angst over this plot, this plan to kill all of them with the king's concurrence. So it's not exactly a secret that could be kept, is it, what's going to take place? So Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish, and she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. So Esther gets word of this plot, Haman's plot. She tries to get Mordecai where he can perhaps get a little closer to her by sending him some clothes to put on, other than the sackcloth and ashes, but he refused to take those. So Esther summoned these couple eunuchs, Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and learn what this was and why it was. So she sends out a representative to Mordecai and says, what the heck? What's going on here, Mordecai? So Mordecai told this guy, this representative from Esther, all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. So she knows the plot. She knows how much bribe money Haman had offered to the king. So she's starting to piece things together. And he also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction. So he gets the word back to Esther via one of her eunuchs, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go to the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. So it was Mordecai's hope that once Esther got a copy of the plot, that she could go into the king and plead the Jews' case. Now, this is a bit of a real cold orientation between Esther and the king, so it's not quite as simple as having her just prance into his presence and say, "Hey, look at this. You got to stop this." But she knows what's needed. So Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther, and Esther spoke to this Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king in the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, and that be put to death." You can't just walk into the king's courtyard and say, we need to talk. I got this problem I need to run by you. If you walk into his presence without being summoned by him, they just chopped your head off or put you to death some other way. You can't do that. There's an exception to that, and that is unless the king holds out the scepter so that that person may live. If he holds out his scepter and you come up and touch the scepter, he's accepting you in his presence and you're okay. You can then talk to him in that sense. But if you try to walk up to him, like judges in the courtyard, "May we approach, Your Honor?" No, you can't approach. You're just killed. So Esther says, "Look, I can't just parade in there and start pleading my case here. I've not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. She hasn't talked to the guy in 30 days. Maybe that's why the marriage is working. I don't know. It clearly isn't like anything we're familiar with. So for 30 days, she hasn't talked to the guy, and she can't just parade in there and plead Mordecai's and all of the Jews' case. So Mordecai reminds her of something that she needs to be reminded of. Verse 13 of chapter 4, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the other Jews." Hey, Esther, remember, you're a Jew too. And do you think when the Kill the Jews Day rolls around that you somehow or another will be exempted from this law? What planet are you living on, Esther? If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. So Mordecai says, "Look, if you don't intervene and help us here, we're going to do the best we can to take care of ourselves, and you're going to end up a walking dead woman like everybody else. And who knows whether you have not attained loyalty for such a time as this?" So Mordecai kind of is thinking a little bit like Joseph. Remember, Joseph tells his brothers, you guys were trying to hurt me, but God brought me to this place of second in command in Egypt to protect you. Joseph understood God's sovereign working in his life to put him in that position. And Mordecai reminds Esther that maybe she's in a similar position. Maybe her being placed as queen over the Persian Empire is so that she too can now help the Jews at this time. Maybe that's why you're there, Esther. You know, we would never accuse Mordecai of being a theological giant in this storyline, but he's got a little insight into divine providence, doesn't he? His rationale is sound. Maybe you're there because God put you there to help, Esther. Maybe Esther had not thought about that. Maybe this is bringing to her cognizance, her thought process, the truth, that is why she's there. How did she beat out all those other young ladies? Are you that much prettier than they? No, you ain't. These are the best, prettiest women in the entire Persian Empire, and you beat them all out? How did that happen? Maybe she's thought about that before now. a little bit. Maybe she's thought about, how in the world did I end up here? When all these other girls are just as pretty as I am. They're just as winsome as I am. That's a good jug. You know what makes that a good jug? You don't have to tip it up in front of your face when you're driving, which blinds you to the traffic. You can just and continue to look down the road. Get you one of these if you use it driving. Much better than a tip up. Yeah. And wifey wasn't even driving when she picked that out. But that's a good jug. Yeah. That wasn't part of the Esther theme, but it's, you know.
Commercial break.
What's in there?
Yeah.
That's probably a commercial break.
That's right. Commercial break.
Perhaps even
for water jugs. So, the situation is dire. Mordecai has appealed to Esther to intervene. She knows that that puts her life at risk if the king doesn't summon her. She can't just walk in there, so she's between a rock and a hard place. So how are we going to get all this resolved, I wonder? So verse 15, Esther told the eunuchs to reply back to Mordecai. It says, go assemble all the Jews that are found in Susa, this was the capital of the Persian Empire, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days and night or day, and I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, but if I perish, I perish. Give me 3 days of praying about this and fasting, and I'll approach him. And if he just has me killed, he has me killed. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there some precedence for the 3 days that I'm not aware of?
I don't know. Probably could go back into Exodus and Leviticus and see what all the laws and rules were about fasting, and it may say 3 days is kind of the norm for whatever. I don't recall offhand, but it may be. It may be that's the rule. She may know that. But it is interesting as to why she asked for the 3 days instead of five or a week or whatever the case may be. Probably there's something there. But I'd have to go research it a little bit and find it. So, Mordecai's attempt to try to help his fellow Jews has been transferred to Esther's lap. She can't just act on it the way she would like because of these crazy laws and rules of the Persian Empire. If she approaches the king and he doesn't ask to see her, it just kills her. Ridiculous, isn't it? Well, let's go ahead and cut a little bit more of the storyline. We'll go ahead into chapter 5. Came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. So Esther dresses up, puts on her Sunday go to meet and stuff, and goes and stands in a place that he can see her. And it happened when the king saw Esther. Now, she didn't just prance right in there and start bending his ear. She just stands back and hopes that he sees her and will ask her to come in. So when the king saw her standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. So she gets her invitation. Remember, they've been apart for 30 days. I'd be curious what she had on. He can see her, and he likes what he sees. Esther, come on in here. Let's talk a little bit while you're here. So she does get to him without getting her head lopped off. And he says to her, verse 3, what's troubling you, Queen Esther? What is your request? What do you want? Even to half of the kingdom it will be given to you. Now, that's a pretty good offer right there, isn't it? Half of the Persian Empire now she owns. That ain't a bad deal. She could have said, forget this other nonsense. I just want half the kingdom. But she is not of that character, fortunately. And so, she says in verse 4, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. So, she says to the king, well, I've prepared this little banquet for you and Haman. How about you guys coming over and joining me in this banquet that I have prepared for you? And so the king says, well, get Haman in here that we may do as Esther desires. So they round him up and they came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So she's kind of getting them separated together in a nice atmosphere for them. So Esther had answered and said, verse 6, and as they drank their wine at the banquet. Now, that's always helpful to try to get as much wine in everybody as you possibly can, as quickly as you can, so that your decision-making is really good. So the king says to Esther, well, what's your petition? For it shall be granted to you. What is your request? Even to half of the kingdom shall be done. So he asks her again, what is it that she wanted? So she answered and said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says. Come to another banquet tomorrow, and I'll tell you what it is I want. At this point in time, if I was Haman or the king, I'd start to wonder, what the heck is going on here? We don't need a banquet every day. Anyway, that's what she asks for. And so they agree. So then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. So Haman heads to the house and he passes Mordecai and he has another one of his hate fits and can't stand the fact that Mordecai didn't jump up and salute him. But Haman controlled himself, however, went on to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. So he gets together his friends and family, and he's going to kind of recount for them how wonderful everything is going for him. So Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, which is 10, and every instance where the king had been magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. So he started does a little summary in front of his buds and family about how great and wonderful he is. And now the king recognizes that and is treating him that way. And Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared, and tomorrow I am invited by her with the king. So he even blows about the fact that he's the only one invited to Esther's banquet besides the king. Yet all of this did not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He still can't get past his hatred for Mordecai. All of this stuff that he just rattles off that is great and wonderful about him doesn't matter because Mordecai is still breathing. And he can't stand that. So then Zeresh's wife and his friend said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Boy, how'd you like to have her in your group of friends? She suggests they build this gallows 75 feet high where everybody in the city could see the guy and hang that sucker Mordecai on it. You don't have to keep putting up with him. Then joyfully with the king, go to the banquet. And that advice pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. So wifey came up with a good plan as far as Haman is concerned. They're going to build this high gallows, 75 feet high thing to stretch old Mordecai's neck on. And boy, Haman thought that was a good plan. So he says, I'll do it. So he did. He has the gallows built overnight. Probably a good time to break, but things take a turn in chapter 6. Are you seeing instances of events and decision-making, wise in the road, that seem to maybe be a little bit defiant of human logic. Things that, well, you know, that could have gone another way. Esther standing out there waiting for the king to see her and invite her in, he might have been busy and said, "Get out of here. I ain't got time to mess with you now." You know, it could have gone another way. All of these decision-making instances and event initiations could have gone another way. And I'm listing all of these. I'm up to 20 so far of these, and we'll review all of them when we get through all of them. I think I was up to 20. Yeah, 20 different ones of these we'll talk about in this storyline when we get them all compiled. So, we don't have the bottom line yet. We're still worried. Mordecai could still be killed. The Jews could still be victims of this massacre put together by Haman. So we don't know yet. We're going to have to worry about these guys for another week. We'll finish it next week, see what happens, and we'll see how God works out his promise to Abraham about blessing those that bless him and cursing those that curse him. So don't lose any sleep over the story now during the next week. Everything will be okay, but we don't have our answer yet. We'll get it. Questions, comments about this storyline?
You started the topic today with a comment about the nature of the change in political environment. There's many similarities I can see between that and the story of the Trump assassination.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. This is not all that unusual or rare, is it? So it happened between these two chapters, the story of how the exiles that remain in Babylon or in the Persian Empire, how are they cared for? We know the ones that have come back, they're under the leadership and the help of Zerubbabel and the political leader and God sending his prophets to them and all that. But how about the ones that are still back there? How about the Mordecais and the Esthers and the ones that are still in Susa? How does God take care of them? And this story is showing us how. Any questions or comments?
Well, I just think that you have to do some research to understand the whole dynamic of why Mordecai would not acknowledge or bow down to Haman.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way back to Exodus 17, where it says he was an Agite, but they were part of the Amalites.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to prevent the Jews, the Israelis, they weren't Jews then, from
going
into the promised land. And it was written in there, and in, also there was another with Agai, the king of the Amalites, who was ordered by God to be destroyed. And it says in there that there was always going to be enmity between any remaining Amalekites, Agites, and the Jews.
Yeah.
So Mordecai knew who this guy was, even though he didn't really know that Mordecai was a Jew at that point. He was told later. And so that's the reason why he would not salute him, even though he had received a high rank from the king.
But you notice that Mordecai doesn't initiate any action against this guy. All the action is initiated against him.
Right.
The enemy of the Jews are taking the action against the Jews. The Jews ain't taking action against their enemy. At least there's no record of it.
I can understand why, you know, Haman received a position of authority, and he expects everyone to, you know, respect him for that.
Sure.
But Mordecai, knowing that he was an Agite, and part, therefore an Amalekite, says no, I'm not going to show any respect because your people have always hated my people, and we were told not to watch y'all either.
Mordecai is salt in Haman's wound. It's not the other way around so much. I guess Mordecai just ignored the guy and go on with life, but Haman can't. He hates him so badly, he's got to try to initiate some kind of destructive plan. And it we'll see how the destructive plan works out before we're done here.
You covered some of it there, Jack, I think, too. But and each one may have to be considered individually, but I'm thinking back over the stories that we read, you know, from the Bible, that this hate, you know, is that, you know, in each case, I think that Pharaoh and some, all along the stories and David and so on, and those who hated him, and is some of this implanted from God, is it not?
Yeah, even Joseph knew that.
Yeah.
He told his brothers, look, you guys were trying to nail me here. You're trying to do me harm.
Yeah.
But God used this for good.
Yeah.
So he knew the principle, that Joseph did.
Pressing on in such a beautiful
way. Yeah.
Okay, well, if you look at Exodus 17, verse 16, and it says, and the Lord